Sup, fools, and welcome back. This is the QTR Podcast, first one of 2019. Fucking super stoked to be here. And how about that? First curse word of the new year. It only took, according to my screen, 6 seconds. That's fantastic. That's like every year they show you the first new baby that's been born that year. Well, I'm showing you the first curse word of 2019. It was fuck, and it was 6 seconds into the first podcast in 2019. This is the QTR Podcast. If you don't know the rules of the road for this podcast, I'm going to break them down for you real quick because I don't have a lot of time. Well, actually, I have plenty of time, but I want to make it sound like I'm busy so that you guys think I have a life, but I don't. Listen, that's a whole other story. The point of the matter is I'm not an investment advisor, and I'm definitely not a financial professional, and this is definitely not financial advice. That's number one. Number two is I recommend a 2-drink minimum for this podcast. Now, adjusting for inflation, because now this is the podcast technically our second year, and inflation's targeted at 2%, fucking stupid idea. I know, we'll talk about it at some other point. Today, I'm going to suggest that everybody has a 2.04 drink minimum. I'm doing the 2% in my head, but I think that's what it is. So for this year, I'm recommending a 2.04 drink minimum for the rest of the year. That is your 2-drink minimum adjusted for inflation. And when we hit hyperinflation, we're all going to be fucking hammered. And I can't wait. All right, that's the other thing. The third thing is this podcast is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up through Patreon. They donate a recurring sum to the podcast. I want to shout some of them out real quick because I've got some new ones since last year. And by the way, I'm sorry I haven't done a podcast in a while. Nothing has pissed me off, number one. Number two, I've spent all the holidays basically drinking and eating, and I've just been in various hazes. So I haven't really been able to deal with any of this shit. And here we are. It's the third. I've kind of pulled my shit together. I got Mark Spiegel finally on a fucking phone that works because I just spent 20 minutes with him doing tech support. It felt like the Geek Squad at Best Buy. And when I asked him to take his dog out of the room, this is a true story. Mark's not on the line yet, but when I asked him to take his dog out of the room, I was like, Mark, your dog's barking a lot. He's like, if he barks one more time, I'm going to throw him out the 17th floor window. So then I hear him get up from the I hear him get up from the phone and walk across the room, I guess, to like get the dog out of the room. And just like out of earshot, I can hear him go, come on, you little fucker. So I got Mark Spiegel on the line. First, we'll do the patrons. Some of my newest patrons. Oh, I got the list all fucked up here. Bear with me for a second, folks. It's going to be a long 2019. I can't wait. All right. I want to shout out William Diorio, who I know just re-upped. My brother Russ Valenti actually just re-upped. My friends over at Quantumize. Quantumize.com, Quantamize, have been huge supporters. Those guys have an AI-powered quant research platform that's made for independent investors, guys like you and me. They take hedge fund-style information on 10,000 stocks, 1,000 ETFs, options, and crypto, and they break it down so that dumb fucks like me can use it on their platform. There's a trial link to their service in my podcast description if you want to check it out, but don't feel pressured. That's that. My brother Scott Corsi actually also just checked in as well. He is the author of Debt Slave Economics, which you can actually find a link to also in my profile. That's basically what I've been doing over the last week, selling myself. But, you know, whatever. I'm a filthy man. I don't know what to tell you guys. Here's some people I want to shout out. My friends Bulls, Bears, Pigs checked in. The friends over at flowalgo.com checked in as patrons. Appreciate you guys. Pivotal Capital. I think I follow you guys on Twitter, actually. Pivotal Capital Management. Want to say what's up. Brent Dover. Johnny Doesn't Know checked in. My brother David Hansen. TJ Brown is in the house. Cullen Newland checked in. He's a new patron. Matt Cleat, I think, actually re-upped. He's been down since September, which I appreciate. My fine friend. Haven't met a fucking finer human being than Jim Tilton, my buddy from Las Vegas. Want to say what's up to him. He was kind enough to check in as well. Matt Crum, my brother Trinker, BG, Jack Seneff, Interstellar Ginger Beer checked in. Don't know what you guys are doing, but I have a feeling I would support it, especially in some type of Moscow Mule. If there's an Interstellar Moscow Mule, if there's an Interstellar Vodka and we mix it with Interstellar Ginger Beer, we can make an Interstellar Moscow Mule is what I'm trying to say. By the way, fun fact for you guys, Moscow Mule is the drink I had 3 of at 10 o'clock in the morning before I did my presentation at Whitney Tilson's May Case Learning event, which is available on YouTube. So if you're wondering why I'm sweating profusely in that and appear to be slurring my words, there's your answer. How do you like that? Also want to check in with OU Grad 05, Dale Wetlaffer. Dell Wetla. I'll get it right next time, buddy. MH Sandberg, Dylan Guzzles in the house. Adita Agarwal, what's going on? My friend Michael Lippman, Wooter Verdenlin, all these guys. And I'm going to shout out just two or three more of them before I get Spiegel on the line. A couple of randos. M. Klein, what's going on, my brother? How about Jesse Collins? Down since September 18th of 2018. I can now say last year. Jesse Collins, I appreciate you, my brother. Adam Pedraza, I feel like I always say his name. Mick Dosti was talking some shit on Twitter today. What's going on, brother? VerifiedExchange.com is in the house. Drew Knowles is in the house. Chris Boas, Chris Bede, Ken R., the usual suspects that come through in a big way. And my man Sam Pearson hit me with an email today or yesterday, so I'll say what's up to him too. And finally, Michael Samuels. All right, that's it. I'm done with that shit. Okay. All right, I got Mark Spiegel on the line here now. Mark from Stanfield Capital, one of the probably most well-known Tesla bears out there, and definitely giving me a run for my money in terms of filthiest, disgusting mouth in finance. Mark, I did say before while I was doing the sponsorship stuff, before I got you back on the phone, that when I asked you to take your dog and move him out of the room, I heard you from across the room go, "Come on, you little fucker." I don't know if I was supposed to hear that. Listen, but
I love my dog. That's a term of endearment with that dog.
Is it?
So don't read that. If you're out there from PETA, believe me, I don't wear fur, and he has a good life, my dog. Trust me. I do eat animals occasionally, but not pigs. Anyway.
Well, PETA, PETA, I think, are hypocrites. Don't they actually wind up euthanizing like a ton of animals on a yearly basis? Do you know that whole controversy?
No.
Okay, so here's how it goes. There was a huge controversy that erupted like years ago about the amount of animals that PETA was euthanizing, I believe. I believe they were just taking animals in, and for one reason or another, because they didn't have the capacity, or they didn't have the they didn't have the resources. But I remember there was a huge controversy about it, that they were just taking animals and killing them, essentially.
Are you sure that wasn't the ASPCA?
No, it was PETA, because there's this band called Goldfinger, right? I don't know if you ever heard of them, but they're a punk ska band that I've listened to for 20 years. And they're huge animal rights advocates. And on one of their albums, they wrote a song called Behind the Mask. And it's a fucking great song. It's a reggae song. I love it. But in the song, they use clips of Ingrid Newkirk's voice, who is the head of PETA. And the song is all about PETA's hypocrisy. And that came out, he's saying in the song, friends turn to enemies. I guess they had a relationship with them back in the day. But that came out right at the same time that I remember this like PETA controversy coming out. And I was in a touring band for, some time way back in another life. And I remember like on the punk ska scene, it was kind of talked about a little bit. But I'm surprised it never broke through to the mainstream.
Well, what I know about the punk ska scene is about as much I know, about, how honest Elon Musk is. I mean, just to circle back to the subject here, which is very, very little.
Well, the subject is whatever we want to make it to be. I was wondering, I just told my listeners I went 6 seconds before I cursed on this podcast. So I was wondering how long it was going to take for you to bring up Tesla if I didn't bring it up.
Well, yeah, we can talk about whatever you want. Yeah, I don't know this. What, by the way, as long as we're on that subject, what instrument did you play in a touring band?
Oh, God, it's not that important. And when I say a touring band, it wasn't like we were, a professional touring band. We were mostly just drinking beer in various parts of the United States.
Well, that is a professional touring band.
I guess so. I guess we had our shit together then.
You have to read a few more musician autobiographies, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about.
I'm not reading shit. You know what I mean? I'm done reading. I'm 36. You know what? I was a lit major in college. I didn't read much then, and I don't read much now.
All right. So,
what's going on? How are you? Did you see the
Q4
delivery numbers? Do you want to exchange
okay
pleasantries? Do you want to talk
end
about
of a horrible year? Hopefully, this year will be better.
Say that again.
The good thing is, as you know or may know,
hold on. We have a bad rhythm here to start off. We were both just talking over each other. This is my fault because I'm the host. I'm supposed to let you talk. Just start over with all that shit you just said.
No, you asked how I was doing. So I said, well, you know, this year is definitely starting off better than last year for us. I'm very happy that I found a bunch of cheap stocks actually to buy as everything was kind of crashing in December, because it had been 18 months before I was really able to add some names. And of course, we continue with our very large Tesla short. And, you know, what I saw yesterday, I mean, it surprised me, you know, to the upside in terms of, I thought things would even be worse. But that said, I know how bad things are going to be coming into, you know, the year we're in now. And you know, so I'm not going anywhere. And I think the stock is heading south. It'll be a bumpy trip, as it always is. But, you know, the hyper growth story for this thing is over.
Yeah, somebody wrote at the end of the day today on Twitter, There's no reason to cover now at this point. But before we even go further, let's just get out with it. What were your numbers like to end the year last year? Just in full disclosure, because you know people are going to talk shit. So let's just address it away.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so fine. So, you know, I think the last time I was on, which wasn't that long ago, we were down in the 17s on the year. And that's where we finished. So for the month of December, you know, preliminarily, I don't have the final numbers from the administrators yet, but preliminarily, we were up 30 basis points in December, you know, which on a relative basis, great. I had a decent relative month, right? Because the S&P was down 9%, and I think the Russell was down like 11 or something like that. But we ended up for the year just as we were at the end of November, roughly, which was in the negative 17% range. So we're up a little this year, but you know, it's only what, the third
of the year. There's a feather in your cap.
Well, you know, it's like CNBC. The January effect for hedge funds,
right?
Then it's great, you know, but I don't think there's a January effect for anything, frankly.
CNBC said at the end of the day today, I saw somebody put on Twitter that the Dow closed down 660, but it was as low as 670.
Oh, well, I saw that. I think that was Diogenes, Wall Street Cynic, which, of course, is Jim Chanos. And he tagged CNBC in there, which had to mean, I'm just guessing because I haven't watched CNBC in forever. He had to be, that had to be Bob Pisani, right? Because Pisani is Mr. Off the Lows, right? You know, the Dow can be down. You know, I look at the S&P, but, you know, the Dow could be down 9,000 points at one point and close down 8,999, and Bob will go, well, it closed off the lows. He's been doing that. He's been doing that for as long as he's been on that network, which might be back to the 80s.
It was Chanos that put that up, but I didn't want to blow him up on Twitter like you just did. So,
well, but he's acknowledged it himself, who he is. It was an institutional investor.
Yeah, but nobody really, you know, talks about it that much. I feel like he should have, you know, 100,000 followers. He only has 20,000 or something. You know, I think if people knew who
he's a pure short seller. I mean, how many loathed and hated categories of people are there who have that many followers?
But he's such a nice guy.
He's a great guy. But, you know, most people are short stocks. They're long stocks. You know, they avoid guys like him. And he's got a lot of wise things to say, and they ignore them until it's too late.
Right. Know? Yep. Yep. When I was doing when I was having Mark check his phone, here's another little tangent I'm going to go off on. When I was having Mark check his phone earlier, when we were checking the audio, I was like, I was like, Mark, can you just talk for a little bit? And he's like, he goes, check 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I'm like, all right, keep talking. He goes, I can't count that high. I got to, and he went back to 1, check 1,
hey,
2.
You know what? I'm a big picture guy. I'm not a numbers guy. Okay.
Oh, God.
I'm a story guy.
I know, buddy. I know. There's just, you know, I like jerking you around.
Yeah. I like that too.
Anyways, so let's talk about the Q4 delivery numbers now that we've exchanged pleasantries. What did you think?
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, if the numbers are genuine, and look, I have no, you know, what struck me as interesting was, you know, as you know from the whole Twitter thing, there's a lot of guys all around the country short the stock, smart guys who all see the same sort of thing going on here. And, you know, they were sort of fanned out at delivery centers all over the country taking pictures and whatever. And
yeah,
there wasn't anywhere near the level of sort of raucous activity at the end of December that there was at the end of September.
Right, I saw that.
And yet, for the numbers to have worked, assuming the estimates were accurate for earlier in the quarter, December would have just had to be, like, insanely more crazy than September. So, I don't know. Maybe Tesla did a fleet sale or something like that.
There were scattered reports about them doing a fleet sale, I believe. Don't quote me, and I could be wrong. I thought I saw something about them doing a fleet sale at one point a while back, number one. But number two, yeah, I saw the same thing as you. I was seeing photographs of the Fremont plant, and it didn't really look like there was a lot going on. I mean, is it possible these cars were in inventory and then people just took delivery from cars that already existed in inventory that were already produced?
Well, but see, this is what we're talking about. So I'm talking about, cars in inventory at the lots. It wasn't like people were lined up, scheduled to pick up their car the same way it was, in September. By the way, the fleet sale, which, as far as I know, has not been acknowledged by Tesla, but it seems like pretty common knowledge out there, was to Enterprise rent a car, which, and then Tesla was renting these cars back to use them as loaner cars for their cars in repair, to their customers. I believe that was done in Q3 rather than in Q4, but I don't know if they did an additional one in Q4. Or, look, maybe they just made the numbers steadily, or maybe they did a lot more home deliveries, so we didn't see the crazy, scene there. But, somebody said something great on Twitter the other day, and I apologize for not remembering who it was, but, Tesla's the only company, only car company in the world that the value can fluctuate by billions of dollars based on 10,000 cars, plus or minus,
Yeah, I saw that same tweet.
And this used to happen, before it got to the scale it's at now. You used to see these fluctuations, based on 500 cars, plus or minus a quarter. So the whole thing is silly, as you know, and what matters is, what happens going forward. It's obvious that U.S. demand is in big trouble, which is why they made those $2,000 price cuts, across the board. That's a lot of money. That's a big chunk of whatever profit they might hope to make. And, of course, Europe, based on the guys who monitor this stuff, on the trackers online and stuff, it only looks apparently as if there's only about 15,000 orders or so far from Europe. Now, obviously, that will accelerate as some cars first start getting over there and, they'll do some walking. But, this is the point. My gut says that in terms of worldwide Model 3s this year, that they're going to sell something like maybe 175,000 to 200,000. I'm thinking like steady state demand in the U.S. now is probably not more than around 75,000 a year. And, let's say 75,000 a year in Europe, which is roughly the size of the U.S. market. And I may be too generous there for Europe. And then, maybe 25,000 a year in China. It's not a competitive car in China with the tariffs and everything else.
The Chinese auto market right now is just fucking imploding.
Well, the Chinese auto market is in the toilet, but, it was bigger than the U.S. market, right?
To be fair, EVs are I think, the only segment in China that's showing, explosive growth. EVs are – go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, because, through incentives, which for some of the models are going away, but apparently not the high mileage models, but eventually they're all going away there. And, like any other place where EVs sell well, the government's trying to force people into them, but there are so many homegrown EVs there. So, circling back, my guess is that worldwide demand for this car is something like maybe 175,000 a year. I don't know, maybe 200,000 a year. But whatever it is, it's less than capacity in that factory. And, right. And of course, Tesla, being just really a bunch of stock hypers, their whole thing has always been to try to create the illusion that their problems never are in demand, right? Their problems are in production, they're in the supply chain, they're in this, they're in that. And it's very damn clear now that they've hit a demand wall, or as Musk might call it, they're in demand hell, right?
Well, let's look at what they've done, right? So they've just over the last month have been trying to get employees to purchase vehicles, number one. I just read that on Zero Hedge that they had some kind of cockamamie scheme. You beta test full self-driving mode or something, and we'll offer you a vehicle. They're cutting prices.
You know, if you were owed vacation time, they were going to credit it towards the cost of a car.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's insane.
Yeah.
Well, that's crazy, number one. And number two, they just cut prices. So they've already cut prices in China, I think, twice, right? And now the car that was to never be discounted, right? 2 years ago, the line from this CEO was, you know, there's so much brand equity, and it's such a luxury vehicle, and there's going to be so much demand, and it's going to be such an unbelievable revolution that we'll never have to market, we'll never have to advertise, and we'll never have to discount a vehicle. And here they are, cutting prices.
Well, let's unpack two different things there. First, you mentioned China. It's hard to track, you know, what pricing really is in China. Obviously, I guess it's doable if you just go back and look. But, you know, don't forget the standard tariff for foreign automakers in China is 15%, and they slapped that extra 25% on the U.S. So originally Tesla cut the price to eat some of that extra 25% tariff, and now that it's all gone, you know, they cut the price more. I don't know what pricing looks like, you know, relative to U.S. pricing if you adjust for shipping and tariffs and all that. I just haven't looked. So, you know, in fairness, that cut went with the tariff cut. But the other thing you said, which is more bigger picture, Tesla has been discounting brand new inventory, you know, for years. I mean, you know, it's just it's not even a secret. I mean, you know, you can look online. There were guys who tracked the inventory, and you could see all brand new cars. You know, the mileage listed would be 50 miles, which is basically the standard, you know, what they would list for a brand new car.
Right.
And they've always been discounting their cars. So there's nothing new there. What's new here is, you know, reports of pretty good discounts on Model 3s, right? So this all circles back to, you know, Musk, you know, originally in 2017, Musk had promised, he said, you should have zero doubt that by the end of 2018, we'll be producing Model 3s at the rate of 10,000 cars per week. And of course, that was total bullshit and very possibly fraud, you know, used to sell that bond offering, which they did, and they're being sued over that and potentially investigated by the DOJ over that, you know, so there's been reports about that. So he said 10,000 a week. And then, but even on the last conference call, I believe it was, he said, it's really easy for us to scale up to 7,000 a week with, you know, minimal CapEx. You know, after that, it gets hard. I'm paraphrasing, but that's roughly what he said. And you know, the bulls and the Teslamians get all excited. And, you know, and by the way, Moody's rating apparently has been based on, you know, continued growth in production. So not only can they not produce that many, and it comes down to a paint shop issue, which has been widely reported by some guys who really studied this thing. And when I say that many, I mean Model 3s, you know, plus the necessary S and X. But there isn't demand for it, you know? I mean, this, if you believe what they quoted as the production number, and there's definitely a history of bullshit from Tesla on that, because they would count cars as produced that then needed massive reworking before they could be sold. But even if we take it on faith that what they said was true, I think it comes out to around 4,700 a week or something like that, which is really barely different from the previous quarter. You know, the previous quarter was also over 4,000 a week. It's pretty clear that they're probably maxed out at production, and they're definitely maxed out at demand. And, you know, this is a story. This is a stock that's priced for just massive growth, you know, massive growth. And that's it, man. There's no more growth than the Model 3. They will be lucky to sell Fremont capacity, you know, worldwide in the Model 3. They'll be lucky. And that's well under 5,000 cars a week.
Well, they certainly.
Then, of course, what about the Model Y? Well, you know,
they're going to need CapEx. I mean, that's not going to come off the same line, right?
Well, my guess is here's my guess, and this, you know, just putting two and two together. The Model Y, you know, once it's ever out there, will hugely cannibalize the Model 3. You know, the same way small crossovers are cannibalizing sedans for every other car company. I mean, to the point that some car companies just stopped making most of their sedans, right? GM and Ford are talking about that. So, you know, my guess is that perhaps they will eventually get this Model 3 plant open in China. And that's a whole nother story because, of course, now it's just a dirt patch. And everything I've read says it takes a year to build a factory and then a year to set up, you know, best case.
And he had said on the previous conference call that they're, you know, they expect to be up and running and producing vehicles there in like the second half of this year or something, didn't he?
Yeah. Maybe with another fucking circus tent, right? I mean, you know, maybe they'll ship over vehicles that are like 95% completed and, you know, have some Chinese guys slap together the last 5% and hope they fool the government into letting them beat the tariff way. Oh, that's a typical Musk move, right? So, you know, so eventually they'll have a factory in China, I'm guessing, if they can get the money for it. That's a whole nother issue. I mean, is there enough stupid money, you know, left in China for that? I don't know anymore, but if there is, then they'll get that. But, and then my guess is that they'll put a Model Y line, you know, in Fremont would be my guess. Or, you know, maybe they put a Model Y line in Reno in the Gigafactory there. But, you know, so my guess is they won't need another building if they build the China plant because there isn't enough demand to use Fremont to full capacity. And on top of that, Model S and X sales are going to take a huge hit this year because, you know, as it is, the Jaguar I-Pace, which last quarter was the only luxury competitor to those guys, it took a big chunk out of their sales in Norway and Netherlands. Which are the two heavily subsidized markets in Europe. And of course, Netherlands, that big subsidy is getting slashed drastically to the point sales are going to die there for everybody. But my point is, you know, just with the I-Pace out, it crushed S and X sales. And now you've got this Audi e-tron, the electric SUV, which just goes on sale literally like this month.
It's a nice looking car, by the way.
Yeah, it's cool. It'll be in the U.S. in April. And then mid-year in Europe is the first Mercedes electric crossover of many. You know, the EQC, that's out in June in Europe. That comes here a year from now. And then the Porsche Taycan, which, of course, is the car of all cars, that comes out, you know, in the fall of this year. These things are going to combine. You know, my guess is that just in 2019, that combined S and X sales take like a 25% hit to 2018 and a much worse hit in 2020 when the Porsche has been out for a full year, the Mercedes has been out for a full year, et cetera, et cetera. And those are much higher margin cars for Tesla than Model 3s. I mean, on the back of an envelope, you know, on the math that I do some math. My guess is that Tesla has to sell like 2.5 Model 3s for every lost, you know, S or X sale, you know, and they're gonna lose a lot of sales. So this is like a long-winded way of saying that, you know, lest we forget,
they're still expected to at some point sell one of these Model 3s for $35,000 before tax incentives.
I don't think that can ever happen without them losing money. I mean, you know, on the back of my envelope, my guess is that a base Model 3, which would be, you know, a 220-mile car, presumably, just for them to build it at zero EBIT profit would probably cost them around $40,000, okay? So even if they were to say, hey, we'll sell this car, break even, and then hope to make money on the options, you know, hope to get the average selling price up, I don't know how much demand there would be for that. And here's why. The long range Model 3, the rear wheel drive long range, which they just discontinued, you know, to switch it to all wheel drive. But that car, they were choking on inventory on that car. It was a $50,000 car, right, including the delivery charge. But it only cost you $42,500 with that full tax credit, right? They ran out of demand for that car. Like, it just, like, they were choking on inventory of long-range rear-wheel drive cars at $42,500 for a 310-mile car or whatever it is. How many 220-mile cars, right, are they going to sell at $40,000? Because that's what it's going to be. There's going to be, you know, the tax credit is in half now, but by the time that car is out, it'll be down to it'll be halved again in the second half of this year, and then it goes away completely, zero, in, you know, a year from now. So if that car really costs $40,000, which I think is the break-even number for Tesla, you know, maybe it's $39,000 plus $1,000 shipping, but we're talking about the same thing. You know, with 50% more range for another $2,500, they ran out of demand.
Right.
So I think there's the you know, I've said this many times. Many people have said it. The huge demand and the huge reservation count, however real it was or wasn't, was for a mythical fraudulent car that Musk promoted, which was a $35,000 Model 3 that came with a full $7,500 tax credit, right? So it would cost you, you know, $28,000 right, or whatever the number is, right?
I'll do that math for you.
right. And it would have, you know, it would cost you $27,500, and it would have, you know, full self-driving. It would drive you to work every day.
Right.
You know, while you were at work, it would be working for you, giving people rides for money all over town.
Then it would make you an omelet,
and it would blow you, right? And then it would take you home and maybe blow you again. And this whole thing would cost you, you know, $27,500. Well, that was total fantasy bullshit. And now what they'll come out with will be some car that costs $40,000, or, you know, maybe $39,000 plus shipping or whatever, and there'll be no tax credit other than a tiny one, you know, for a few months before it expires, and it won't do any of those things. So again, the car they'll come out with, if there were real demand for it, they wouldn't have the Model 3 problems now, because that $7,500 you get now,
right,
you're not getting a year from now. So, you know, this whole thing comes back to the demand is nowhere near what the bulls think it is. Model S and X is going to get hurt this year. That means Tesla, you know, Tesla had that $300 million gap profit, which we reviewed last time, so we won't spend time on it now in Q3. They'll have a gap profit, my guess is, for Q4. You know, my guess is it's smaller. You know, maybe it's $100 million less. I don't know, maybe it's $200. I haven't figured that out yet. Whatever it is, it's the last two profitable quarters you will ever see from this company, and they revert to losses next year and like forevermore until they're restructured.
So here's one thing that we didn't talk about since last time, because this happened in between the last time we spoke and now, which I just can't wait to get your take on, and that is whether or not you saw, which of course I know you did, so what you thought of the Boring Company tunnel reveal. I mean, are we flying face first into the future here, or what? Did you see that thing? It looked like fucking bumper cars that you see at the fair.
You know, here's what I'll say about that. And by the way, I did not stay up to watch it. So, you know,
subsequent to that, you've seen it though, right?
Yeah, of course. I saw it, yeah. Here's what I'll say about that. To its credit, the media is finally on to what a huckster this guy is.
Yeah, that reveal.
And he was widely mocked for this thing. And he wasn't just mocked for it, you know, from people like you and me, but I mean, there was like serious libtard mocking going on of this guy, you know, like your guys who are like, who think all cars are evil and public transportation will, you know, is the cure for everything and blah, 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 blah. And by the way, you know, I hardly ever take my car out of the garage. So it's ironic that I probably put, you know, fewer miles on than almost anybody in the country. But anyway, you know, even those people were like, this is the stupidest, you know, dumbest thing ever. So, you know, it's just a, I mean, come on. I mean, you know, the guy bought two or three used tunneling machines, right, and just repainted them and pretended he invented something. I mean, the best thing about this guy, and, you know, people have sent this, everyone's seen it by now, but that episode of The Simpsons with the monorail.
Yeah, everybody has made that comparison, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was so prescient on the part of you know, whoever did that, Matt Groening, whoever does Sims. I mean, it's ridiculous, but people are catching on, most of them.
Well, that was the one thing I noticed about this unveiling, was that it really seemed to permeate into the mainstream a lot more. And I think I even put out a tweet that said, look, you know, this idea is so ludicrous and it's so obviously ridiculous that A, the media picked it up, so you know it has to be on its face a ridiculous idea for the media to not swoon over it right away. You know, yeah. Even though there was that CBS report where they took the reporter and they were driving through the tunnel, even she was like, "Is this supposed to be this bumpy?" You know, And of course, Elon, I thought, looked very nervous. Maybe it was the way that the GoPro was situated on the inside of the car when they were driving, but he looked fucking nervous when she was asking him questions. Like, is it supposed to be doing this? Like, is it supposed to be this ridiculous? But then all of the subsequent media coverage to that came out really seemed to nail it. And you got to know that an idea is fucking stupid when the people in the mainstream media start to pick it up and start to question it, especially when it involves Elon Musk, who has been a darling and a favorite of theirs for years, not so much lately. But, I mean, that I thought was the most telling thing. And I said on a previous podcast, I think maybe one of the last ones I did last year, that if that message starts to kind of get through to, look, you're always going to have those people that are, you know, seeking utopia and are ideological, kind of looking for whatever it is they're looking for, that are, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tails and want to go work for Elon and want to drive their electric cars, and maybe they don't really understand the economics of it, or they don't understand what's feasible. I mean, you're always going to have those people. But and really, you're not going to be able to change those people. They are far, far gone, some of them. However, I thought that this event was ridiculous enough that it might get to some people that are kind of on the border there. Some people that, you know, have heard some good stuff about Elon and heard some bad stuff and are still maybe trying to make up their mind. And even at Christmas this year, one of my family members made mention of it to me, somebody who's traditionally on the left and probably, you know, had supported him in his endeavors and thought that it was, you know, an altruistic thing that he's doing, made some comment to me like, what is he doing? You know? And I'm like, yeah, I've been fucking saying that for 2 years. And guys like you, Mark, you've been saying that for a lot longer than that.
Musk has been undergoing what I kind of call a slow motion shark jump. And I think it started, it was Memorial Day of this past summer, when he started complaining a weekend, Twitter storm, complaining about the media. And that's when he first said he was going to found this thing called Pravda, P-R-A-V-D-U-H. And he started calling out the media. And of course, when that happened, you know, the media sort of, you know, pulls together because, you know, and they have each other's backs. And that's when I saw a lot of media people start questioning him. And then, of course, there was the weekend in, I guess it was in July, when on the Saturday it revealed he was a big Republican donor. And, you know, that's... You can't be worse than that for the media. And then on Sunday was the whole thing, of course, with the paved guy and the pedo and all that thing. So that was like the second, you know, arc of this sort of slow motion shark jump, right? And then the whole 420 thing, you know, that was like the third arc. And then this was another arc. It's kind of a gradual erosion rather than a one-time event. But yeah, I mean, he sort of managed to piss off, you know, almost every possible constituency except the most hardcore of hardcore. But, you know, look, here's the thing.
Well, you would think that it would have to be an erosion because of how you know, ingrained into the psyche of the country and everybody it was in the years prior to that. You know, even I was supporting him back in 2012, 2013. You know, I thought what he was doing was admirable. And I thought, you know, before it kind of became clear that maybe, you know, because actually at the beginning, if I remember correctly, he was doing a little bit more executing on exactly what he said he would do and a little less reaching for the stars and coming up far short, if I remember correctly. And then it was about 2014, 2015, I started to be, all right, you know, this guy's starting to miss a little bit here, and some of these things are starting to be a little bit questionable. Now it's just, to me, I don't know, you talk about the Unsworth thing, which is a perfect example. Did you see his motion to dismiss that lawsuit?
Yeah. He basically said, well, everything I say on Twitter is bullshit, so no one should think I was being serious there.
But right? as it was happening, and for those of you that don't know what happened, I'm sure everybody knows at this point, but he called one of the heroic cave divers of the Thai cave rescue a pedo on Twitter. Okay. And then after the guy didn't sue him for calling him a pedo, doubled down on it and called him a child rapist and said that he had married a 12-year-old bride. And otherwise, why would he be in Thailand? And he spent all this time talking about this guy who, by the way, just, I think, received whatever the Medal of Freedom is or the Medal of Honor is in England. I forget what it's called when they anoint you in MBE.
Yeah.
Right. So that guy he chose to pick a fight with, and Musk said, oh, you know, because the guy hasn't sued me, it must not be true. So then, of course, the guy turned around and fucking sued him. And then Musk's lawyer, who he's probably paying, you know, a substantial amount of money to, files this motion a couple days ago to dismiss the lawsuit that's been lodged against him, stating exactly what you said. Not only, oh, everything I say on Twitter is bullshit, but, you know, hey, what I say can't be construed as fact. After he argued over and over and over that he knew that this guy was a pedophile, Mark, to the point where at one point I even thought to myself, maybe Musk does have something on this guy. Maybe he hired some private investigators and they dug up some shit on this guy. And it turns out, nah, just fucking making stuff up.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Well, I was so shocked when I saw that first tweet because I think the way I'm just going from memory, but I think he said, you know, maybe something like, you know, hey, maybe you should shut up, pedo guy, or something like that. And I'm like, what? What did he just type?
He said, sorry, pedo guy.
I go online. What's that?
He said, sorry, pedo guy, but you really asked for it.
Yeah, yeah. So then I go online in the Urban Dictionary because I'm like, wait, there's no way that could mean what I think that means. And I'm thinking, okay, there must be some other meaning, you know, for pedo, some slang that, you know, I'm not so hip anymore. I don't know. And I'm like, nope, it's exactly what I couldn't believe he said. Yeah. But anyway, so, of course,
as this is happening, the board of directors sitting idly by. Right. Kimball Musk in his cowboy hat and his, you know, plant a seed day. I mean, this guy is on fucking Jupiter somewhere. Kimball Musk.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Kimball is like, you know, the dumb younger brother who just, you know, is along for the wealthy ride. Here's the thing. And you bring up a great point. And any other CEO in America would have been fired the next morning
immediately
for doing that, right? Or forced to take a leave of absence and get his mental health checked or whatever, right?
Immediately.
Nothing happens. And then, of course, you know, after that, I don't know, a month or so later, came the 420 thing, and any CEO who did that would have been fired within 15 minutes.
Yeah,
right?
And would be in jail.
Instead, it came together with a bullshit story that they made up like a retroactive story to somehow defend him or whatever. The whole thing was absurd, right? So, but we know all this, and we're just, you know, and of course, you know, the SEC was supposed to take care of this. But what we haven't talked about, because it's part of the whole thing, I don't think we talked about how the quote-unquote independent chairman, he said in an interview, oh, you know, she just does whatever I want. I can control her. I think that was on 60 Minutes, right? I don't even talk about that.
Yeah,
and of course is Larry Ellison. Go ahead. What were you going
to
say?
Well, we'll talk about those in 1 second. Yeah, but he did say that. But just to go back to what you're saying about the 420 tweet, not only that, but then he went on 60 Minutes in that same interview. It's just to be clear, I do not respect the SEC. I do not respect them. And then after that, just yesterday or 2 days ago at 420 in the morning or 420 in the afternoon, he put out a tweet that just said, ha ha. So he is openly mocking the regulators still.
Right. Now, look, you know, this is America. It's probably not against the law. I'm sure it's not against the law mock regulators.
It's not.
It's just really fucking stupid. Mm-hmm. But it's not against the law. There was probably nothing in that settlement that said he couldn't go on at 420 and type a hub. But here's the deal. This company desperately needs cash, right? And the only way you can raise money, not the only way, but, you know, the way to raise money is you got to get a registration statement through. I mean, if you were the SEC right now, I mean, even if they were working, which they're not because of this government shutdown, I mean, you'd have to think those guys would be slow walking his registration statement just letting this company bleed out, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's pretty much, like you said, it's not against the law. It's just fucking stupid. He's poking the bear. He's openly starting a war with the SEC is what he's doing.
Exactly.
And you know what? Every time he comes out and does something stupid like this fucking bumper car, you know, it looked like a mix between the bumper cars at the fairs and bumper bowling. That's what it reminded me of when you would bowl, you know, when you were a kid, but you had to throw the 6-pound ball and the fucking thing would ping pong off of the inflatable bumpers, bum, 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 all the way until it got to the end and knocked down one pin. That's what it reminded me of. It reminded me of if you took a bumper car and you put it onto a bumper bowling alley and you shoved it down there. Every time he does something like that is so clearly not an innovation, all it does is probably fuel the fire at the regulators. Like, hey, you know, look, maybe internally we've been saying that this guy's a... Go ahead.
So, we should speculate a little bit about, you know, why he might be doing this. And it's possible that he may realize he is so legally fucked that it doesn't matter. I mean, the guy who he brought in as the new general counsel is this renowned, you know, white-collar criminal fraud defense attorney. I mean, you know, and by the way, he's only doing this apparently as a part-time job. Apparently he's maintaining his his partnership at the law firm in D.C. But, you know, what company hires somebody like that to be – I mean, the general counsel is just supposed to be a guy who – signs off on boilerplate contracts and, you know,
and basically delegates to other lawyers that you've hired for, you know, he's basically supposed to be the ringleader for other lawyers that your company hires for various, you know, types of litigation.
And his statement when he got hired, the official statement Tesla put out was something like, and again, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, I believe in the mission. It's very important that that I help Tesla survive, you know. That's not something that I'd be too thrilled about if I were a bull on this stock, you know. But, you know, before we get to, you know, where I know we'll get with Larry Ellison, we should bring up the point that, you know, that allegedly responsible institutional investors like Bailey Gifford that runs – I looked on Wikipedia the other day. They run, like, in total, I think they have almost 200 billion pounds. You know, that's – you know, it's an unbelievable amount of money. Or T. Rowe Price, of course, which is probably somewhere around $1 trillion. I mean, obviously massive, right? That these guys, not only did they not dump their stock after the pedo thing, but some of them, T. Rowe, I think, bought more.
Yeah, I think Gifford did,
too. And then they didn't dump it again after the 420 thing. These are just greedy motherfuckers who think, oh, this is a hyper-growth company. We're going to make a lot of money here, right? Well, now it's not a hyper-growth company anymore. And these stupid, greedy MFers now are going to be like, oh, the hypergrowth is gone. And these guys are very good chance they're going to be sellers. And if they aren't, you know, there's a lot of other institutional investors.
Or you know what? They might just go down with it because it's just not a lot of capital for them. You know what I mean? I mean, there's just.
Oh, it's a lot of capital. It's billions of dollars.
Well, if you have $200 billion under management, it's...
That's not how it works. I mean, you know, this guy, James whatever, you know, this is a big part of his book. I don't know what percentage it is. I mean, he's not running the whole 200 billion pounds himself, you know.
Right.
These are meaningful positions for you guys. And by the way, Bailey Gifford owned every piece of shit bubble stock, you know, that there was. And by the way, not every bubble stock is a piece of shit the way Tesla is. They just had insane piece of shit, stupid valuations. I mean, his book was like the book of hyper stupidity, bubble market stupidity. So, you know, he's got to be getting crushed in all this stuff anyway. But at some point, you know, even a guy who doesn't care, you know, if Elon Musk rapes a goat. And by the way, I'm not accusing him of having done that at all. But I'm just saying if he did do that, these guys wouldn't care as long as the company's growing, apparently. I mean, I would not have believed this if you told me this 2 years ago.
Well, it's not like they need to grow their bottom line either, too. I don't know what they're looking at. I mean, you talk to guys like Ross Gerber, and he brings up sales. You know, he brings up revenue.
Looking at top-line growth.
Right. I guess that's
it. All of a sudden, this is not such a great top-line growth story anymore. And, you know, if they want any top-line growth from here, they're going to have to put in billions into CapEx. And oh, guess what? You just own a fucking shitty car company, you know, led by a pathological liar who committed securities fraud recently and can't deny that as part of his settlement. So I think those guys are going to be out of here. I think they're going to be selling. This is what will get them to sell is a sharp deceleration in top line growth. You know, along with, of course, just a whole crashing bubble sector of the market anyway, right? So. You know, that brings us around to Larry Ellison. And of course, you know, everyone out there listening to this has read all the stuff about, you know, Larry Ellison may just be an enabler of Musk. And by the way, you know, I don't know Larry Ellison, obviously. I know very little about him other than he's a hell of a sportsman. But I do know this, you know, Larry Ellison is unlike Musk, Larry Ellison is a money-making shark, right? He built a massively successful company, a hugely profitable company, a company that throws up a ton of cash. You know, when it comes to actual business sense, He is the anti-Musk. Now, they may share many of the same, you know, personality traits. You know, supposedly Ellison is also an egomaniac. You know, the biography about him, of course, is called, you know, the difference between Larry Ellison and God is God doesn't think he's Larry Ellison. So, you know, and he's a huge Musk fanboy. I mean, he said it in October. There was that story in the Wall Street Journal. I think it was October. And he said, you know, the usual thing, which I'm shocked to hear from somebody as smart as Larry Ellison to hear, oh, you know, he lands rockets on barges. You know, who are you? Right. You know, it's like that's like the dumbest bull case there is for this for many reasons. But anyway, so Larry, you know, has said at that point, this is my second largest position. And then when he was appointed to the board last week, he said he owns, you know, 3 million shares, which is about $1 billion worth of stock, or it was. And the question is, you know, why didn't Larry inject that $1 billion directly into Tesla, who needs it badly? You know, unless he bought that stock, you know, years ago or gradually accumulated it, which is possible, but he made it sound almost as if it were a recent purchase. If it were, I mean, how screwed up is Tesla that they couldn't get the stock registered for Larry or promised to get it registered for him? It was a weird situation. Do you have any thoughts about that?
No. What I do have some what I do have thoughts about is the fact, A, you know, look, I understand what you're saying, that Ellison said, oh, he landed a rocket on a barge. Okay, you know, people have been doing that for 3 decades. Lockheed Martin did that 3 decades ago or whatever it was. Anyways, that's number one. Number two,
I wasn't gonna go there here, but we should take half a minute and just say, you know, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, all these guys have been able to do this for decades.
Right. We've said that a million times over. We're beating a dead horse.
All right,
so here's what's new.
If it were a profitable business, they'd be doing it. Go ahead.
Of course. Just as anything is in a capitalist, you know, when it's only an innovation if it makes economic sense too, right? Anybody could just innovate. I mean, if you dropped me $5 billion tomorrow, I could come up with some fucking, you know, gadget that flies to Jupiter. You know, I surround myself with engineers and pour money into it. You know, it doesn't mean it's going to be cost efficient. Doesn't mean it's going to have a good purpose. Anyways, look, the point I want to make about Ellison, though, is I think the most important thing is that, you know, prior to him signing onto the board, and I think at some point around the time that he made his first investment, he described himself as a very close friend to Elon Musk. And that's all.
Exactly.
That's all you need to know. Okay, so you have the SEC settlement was supposed to bring two independent board members onto the board, okay, for the purposes of keeping an eye on Elon Musk, making sure he doesn't do any fucking stupid shit like he did, and not sitting, you know, idly by and picking his nose like Kimball Musk does when, you know, his brother was putting out those tweets. It was to have two active, engaged, lucid, and spry individuals on the board that theoretically, I guess, could, you know, be people that may be able to rope Elon Musk in. And what did we get? We got Larry Ellison, who's an investor in the company, who describes himself as a very close friend of the CEO. And we have Robin Denholm, the two new board members. We got Ellison and the woman from Walgreens. And then Denholm was made the chairman of the board. And Elon Musk publicly said on 60 Minutes, you know, she just does whatever I want her to do or something like that. He didn't say that verbatim, but he was like, he was asked whether or not Denholm would be able to rope him in. And he said, no, it's just not reasonable. It's just not a realistic scenario. Okay.
Right. So here's my thought process as a guy who's short this stock, right? I love the Denholm thing because she will enable Musk to destroy himself.
Well, she's already allowed him. So whatever is going on there now, whatever we've seen, and then maybe if there's shit going on behind the scenes, whether it's, you know, company culture or there's accounting stuff, who knows? I'm just speculating. She has sat there while it's happened, and so to make her the chairperson of the board means that everything that's already happened is going to continue to be acceptable, right?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And you know, Larry Ellison will also enable, presumably, you know, Musk's worst instincts. So if I were an institutional investor long this stock, I would have wanted to see two sober people with great auto manufacturing experience to come in here.
Of course.
Yeah, but nobody was with real experience is dumb enough to take that job, number one, for probably multiple reasons. One is the company's really fucked up, and number two, they don't want to deal with Elon Musk. So, you know, he got a buddy, and then he got a figurehead, right? So, you know, I'm actually glad about that. Now, as a guy who's short the stock, my only concern is, you know, is Larry Ellison going to be so stupid as to, you know, throw this company a lifeline and prolong its ultimate death by dipping into his own pocket and putting in, you know, another $3 billion.
Now, he might.
What's that?
He might. He's just, you know.
So I don't know. So here's how I'm thinking. Here's how I'm thinking this through out loud. So, you know, Ellison's worth, apparently, at least on paper, it's a lot. Obviously, it's almost all an Oracle stock. But, you know, he's worth $60 billion, right? So $1 billion, you know, 1/60th, you know, that's like sort of play money, right? Like, you know, you bet on a long shot of a stock, you know, if you thought it might have some chance and it was run by your friend, you might put in 1/60th of your money.
Sure.
I'm sure Ellison is a very, very, very smart guy. Yes, he got taken in by Theranos. He did. But you know, Theranos was a tiny investment for him relative to his net worth. I don't know how much he put in there. It was like the tens of millions, I think. And when he did it, he probably realized that he knew nothing about, you know, molecular biology, right? It's just not his thing. And he took a shot and whatever, and he got taken. Okay, fine. But the car business and manufacturing, it's a lot easier for somebody such as him to understand. Even though he's a software guy, this is not molecular biology, and it's not even rocket science, right? And my guess is, he's like, yeah, Lon's a really cool guy. I'm 72. You know, he's like a younger version of me. He's daring. He says, fuck you to the critics. He does this. He does what he wants. And you know what? I'm going to throw it, you know, and we play with our cars together, and we play with our plans, whatever the fuck they do. I'll throw $1 billion in his company. What the hell? Yeah, why not? You know, and then when Musk asked him to be on the board, and this is all speculation, by the way, he probably thought, you know what? I like Elon. He's like a younger version of me, and I do have $1 billion in here. What the hell? I'll go to 4 meetings a year and just keep an eye on my money.
Right.
And I can help him, right? My guess is that Ellison has not deeply dug into this situation. And I think he probably didn't have, you know, the ability, you know, through his background and education to really deeply dig into the Theranos situation, and it was a lot less money. I think here, and look, maybe I'm wrong, but I think here, before he put, let's call it real money for him, like additional billions in, I think he would dig in very deeply and say, no fucking way, right? The way anybody who actually does real homework on this company says. So, you know, if that's correct, then Larry Ellison is like a dream appointment, as far as I'm concerned, as someone who's short the stock, as is Robin Denholm, because they will allow this very self-destructive, you know, pathological liar of a person to destroy himself even faster than he otherwise would.
Well, yeah, but I mean, also, I think it's important not to underestimate the amount of capital that's on the side of the company, right? I mean, Elon is leveraged, right? But we know what he's worth, which is, you know, 20 or 30 billion or whatever. You know, that's not his enterprise value, but he's worth something like that,
well,
as long as the price of Tesla.
So he was allegedly worth around 20, with a big chunk of that being SpaceX. You know, SpaceX is having trouble raising money. SpaceX wanted to raise, what was it, $750 of debt, I think?
Here's the point I'm trying to make, though. If Ellison is worth $60 billion and Musk can, you know, drum up $1 billion or two, you know, they may have enough to push the company forward. You know, look, a while back we tried to speculate how much capital they would need if they wanted to do another raise and how they would do it. And we came up with a lot of common sense scenarios where an investor could, you know, or a consortium of investors could invest $5 billion in like convertible preferreds or something. And that would give the company enough capital to, you know, look, maybe not be consistently profitable, but forge forward somehow into the future.
I don't think there's $5 billion of dumb money out there, especially in this market. And, you know, yes, they could raise. Look, you got a stock that's trading, you know, $2.5-3 billion every day. You know, they could raise a quick billion through a sort of a predatory converter or hedge fund. I mean, I'm not worried about them unless they can't get a registration statement through the SEC, which is possible. But if they can, I'm not worried about that convert. You know, they can just do another ugly convert and pay it off or another, you know. Listen, you know.
What reason would the SEC have for not, you know, for taking their time on putting through a registration statement? What would they say?
You know, it could just be that the DOJ investigation is really ugly, looking potentially at things that are a lot worse than we know about, and they don't want to and Tesla doesn't want to disclose that in a registration statement, which will be required by the SEC. We don't know.
Okay,
you know,
right,
I mean, this is pure. This is only speculation brought about by the fact that it's so obvious they need money. Why haven't they raised it? Right. So we're sort of working backwards into these various scenarios, but I don't think there's $5 billion out there. Even Larry wouldn't put $5 billion in. I mean, that's real fucking money, even for him, right? I mean, he's got to borrow against his Oracle stock for that. No, doesn't matter how. No one has it just lying around in, you know, in their checking account, right? So, you know, the question is would Larry give them, you know, $2 or $3 billion to keep the lights on for an extra year and a half or 2 years or whatever? And I think not. I think that Larry has to be. I'm giving him the credit of being a very, very smart guy who just didn't do a lot of homework on this thing. But if it came to that kind of money, I think he would do a lot of homework, and I think he'd come to the same conclusion that we all have. But I don't know that.
I think there's probably an element to it also, like you're talking about Ellison wanting to kind of stay cool and stay hip. I mean, look, so when I seen a picture of the guy, and admittedly, this is the first time I've seen a picture of him just, you know, a month ago or whenever this happened. I mean, he looks like a 72-year-old guy that has had work done to try and make himself look perpetually young. There's two types of 72-year-olds that you see out there. There's guys that embrace their age and age gracefully, and they go bald and they don't give a fuck, or, you know, they get some wrinkles and they don't give a fuck, you know, and they dress their age and they dress the appropriately. And then you have the guys that go out and they get the fucking hair plugs and they get the facelift and they dye their hair jet black, you know, like fucking Wayne Newton does a billion years old. He's got a matte black head of hair like the, you know. And so Ellison kind of comes off as one of those guys. I just saw a headshot of him, you know, but he just looks like one of those guys that would like McAfee also does the same thing too.
Well, he's
wearing
he
like fucking
wacky
Abercrombie and Fitch and like, you know, getting tattooed and shit at like 72 years old, which admittedly, I mean, look, if I'm still getting tattooed at 72, I think maybe there's a problem there. And so I think there probably is a little bit of an element to it of, you know, he subscribes a little bit to Musk's ethos, you know, which is, look, we're doing something bigger than that. You know, he falls in with this, like, John Laguerre, you know what I mean? Fucking wearing the pink shit all the time and ranting and raving. It's just like, all right, you know, guys, I guess, that have anointed themselves as timeless, you know, as guys that wouldn't age. It's like, just fucking be 72, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that T-Mobile guy, I mean, that's his shtick, right? But by the way, you know, what we didn't talk about, it's sort of not apropos of anything, but it's just so funny, is, you know, part of the statement of Larry Ellison coming aboard was, I believe in the mission.
Right.
This is a fucking guy who's got one of the largest super yachts in the world, a collection of jet planes. He owns at least one, like, Russian fighter jet. God knows how many gallons of jet fuel that thing burns an hour. You know, he did this whole America's Cup thing where he would fly in probably like a 747, the sailboats from one destination to another, because you can't take these things over the open ocean. I mean, come on, this guy believes in the fucking mission? I mean, come on. You know, anyway, but back to a more important point here, which is, you know, has Larry really done any real work here? I think not. You know, with Larry, even though he wants to stay young and hip and everything else, you know, is he going to put multiple more billions into this without doing a lot of work and finding out what you and I and anyone else who has done this work knows? I think the answer is not. But listen, if he does, look, you know, Tesla has a bigger market cap than Ford, GM, you know, BMW, Daimler, or did, you know, as of last week. I haven't checked lately. I mean, so it's absurd. So at the end of the day, you know, Larry could piss away a few billion in here. You know, the stock goes up $30, $40. Oh, Larry's pissing away a few billion. And then people say, oh, but what now? We've got a company selling, you know, 350,000 cars a year. GM sells 9 million cars a year, and GM is massively profitable, and these guys are about to start losing money again. It's not going to matter in the long run. It only matters in the short run, but I suspect it won't even happen. You know, maybe at some point, you know, they look to restructure this thing. You know, maybe they look to, you know, maybe they look to take it private at $10 a share. Who the hell knows? Okay, fine. So I won't make that last $10 on my short position. You know, it's something like that is what's going to happen here.
All right. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about was how do you have any feel for how serious or not serious the DOJ investigation might or might not be? And here's why I'm asking. Because earlier we're talking about the $35,000 Model 3, and that falls into kind of a bucket of statements that Musk has made that, to me, could very easily, I think, you know, from a trying to be as objective as possible here and put my biases aside, there is a litany of statements that this guy has made dating back years, including the one about making 10,000 Model 3s per week by the end of the year this year, that could, I think, in a best case scenario, be argued to be on the borderline of fraudulent. I think in a very best case scenario, you say, well, he, you know, he truly believed he could do this or whatever. He ran the calculations or he wrote them on the back of a cocktail napkin or whatever. Given all of those statements, and they continue to kind of pile up here little by little, how do you have a feel for at all how serious it might be or how serious it might not be? I mean, I've seen these things go away very quickly too.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, there could be a lot of little violations, and you know, maybe he pays a $50 million or Tesla, whatever, pays a $50 million fine. And then the big thing was the bullshit that he used to sell that bond deal. And maybe the DOJ figures, well, let's let him fight that out in court with the investors. And at the end of the day, yeah, that could cost him a nine-figure settlement or Tesla. I mean, you know, there's real expense here. The 420 tweet, I mean, the liability for that could be over $1 billion. It was what, like 17 days until the board finally said, yeah, that was bullshit. Remember they put out that statement like 11 o'clock on a Friday night or whatever? So I don't know what the criminal, but you know, but then again, you know, if you look at Twitter, there's a lot of speculation about what other criminality could be going on there. Is there accounting fraud? Are they, you know, are they playing games on you know, kiting with the ABL? Are they? It's clear that they have far more unregistered cars than any other automaker has as a percentage of what's sold. Are they doing that so they can pocket the state sales tax until they finally have to cough it up? You know, I mean, they're sort of living hand to mouth, this company.
Does that,
right?
Does that relate to this? And I'm not familiar with it, so maybe you can inform me. But I saw, I think it was at Tesla Charts, posted something about there's a gap in the VIN numbers.
Huge. Well,
can you explain that? Explain it to me and explain it to people that might not know what it is.
Well, there's a huge gap between the number of sales that Tesla is reporting and the number of cars, the number of Teslas that are getting registered. And the theory behind that, one theory behind
that
is...
You mean registered by owners or registered by the company for VIN numbers?
Registered by the company.
Okay.
Because what happens is you give, you know, your Tesla, you sell a car, you give somebody a temporary tag, and eventually you give them their regular plates. Apparently, in most states, maybe all states, the state sales tax gets paid when you get the permanent registration. And the theory has been they're just issuing continual temporary registrations on a lot of cars, and they're essentially using the sales tax, you know, to pay their bills. I mean, eventually they have to cough up the sales tax, but you know, this is the theory that this is part of their cash management program. So there has to be some explanation for it. Now, a more nefarious explanation. And I am absolutely not saying this is true, but this would be a more nefarious explanation, is that they're borrowing on their ABL against cars that they've sold, and that if they register the car, then it would show up as sold, and then they, you know, then they would lose the borrowing, that car is part of their borrowing base. I don't know that that's happening. It's just possible, you know, and I'm not saying it's happening. I'm not accusing them of that, but you know, but if that were happening, that's the kind of thing the DOJ would take, you know, extremely seriously, you know, they might take less seriously much bullshitting about the production schedule. They might just say, well, let's leave that for the civil court and let those bondholders, you know, sue his ass over it. So I don't know. This is not my ballywick. This is not my area of expertise.
Yeah, well, that look, that dovetails nicely into a question one of my patrons listed here for you, which just said, you know, it amazes me that the fact that their current liabilities rose by $500 million last quarter while their net revenues came in at $311 million. So aren't they just creating a false profit by running up their short-term debt? You know, which seems like a very simple question, right?
Well, first of all, what you just said was not literally correct. The profit they reported was $311.5 million, right?
Yeah, he said net revenue by accident,
right? Which is wrong. And by taking on more debt, that does nothing to your. You don't book that as revenue as profits. That's debt. So I think the guy's sort of confusing.
I think so too.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, look, I think we dissected
the idea of juicing the cash flow by not paying the bills, I think, is kind of what he's talking about.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, here's the thing. I mean, in fairness to Tesla, you know, the metric for that is days sales and payables.
Right.
And that number actually went down. I mean, it was pretty reasonable for Q3. But I have a theory about that. And again, this is total speculation. But if you remember in the summer, Tesla had talked to all its suppliers,
yep,
and said, hey, we need cash rebates for you guys, yep, in order to survive. Remember, yep, that was a big story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We went over this last time.
What's that?
We went over this theory last time. Go ahead. I don't want to interrupt you.
The payables went down because they basically forgave their suppliers, forgave a bunch of the payables.
Right.
I don't know. That could be an explanation for that.
Yeah, that would make sense because essentially the number for the payables went up. So that would be a way to make that one metric look better while the actual ultimate.
But the point is that the dollar amount of payables went up a fairly small amount relative to the much higher volume of cars they produced.
Okay.
You know, relative to the much higher volume of parts they had to buy to supply, you know, to build those cars. That's why one possible explanation would be if suppliers said, hey, you want rebates? We're not going to write you a check, but you know that $100 million you owe us. Let's call it, you know, $62 million, and then we're even, or you know, whatever.
Have you seen these emails that people are posting on Twitter? I guess they came out in Discovery or somewhere. I don't know where they came out, but or maybe the vendor released them. But guys that are doing work for Tesla are getting stiffed on bills for, you know, like $20,000 and stuff like that.
They've been stiffing small people for a real long time. I mean, it's clear. It's clear that they're sort of living hand to mouth, and I guess they're stiffing as many small people as they can get away with, and then trying to not stiff the big people that could basically shut down, you know, the factory, right? You don't want to stiff the guy.
That's like a Trump move, man.
These are your steering wheels.
That's like a Trump move. You know, that's a move out of his book. So all these people that are out there bitching and moaning about how, you know, Trump didn't pay a lot of the people that worked for him, and that, you know, he stiffed these people because he knew that they wouldn't sue him, and it put companies and businesses, family businesses, out of business. You know, that's essentially what these guys are doing. They're doing the same fucking thing,
But you know, Musk and Trump, all politics aside, they're the same. They're the exact same personality. I mean, we've talked about that. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I mean, you know. So back to your DOJ question. I mean, we could come up with all kinds of theories. We just don't know. But the only thing we do know is these guys have desperately needed cash for a long time, and yet they have not filed a registration statement, you know, to raise cash. And they easily could have, even if it was a relatively small, you know, ugly deal. I mean, hell, you know, if Tesla came to me and said, hey, we're doing an overnight deal, you know, will you take $1 million worth of our stock at a 20% discount to today's close? I'd be like, sure, I'll just blow it all out tomorrow, you know, at an average, you know, price that's a 10% discount, and I'll pocket that difference. And that's how a lot of these deals get done with shitty companies like Tesla, especially when you have a liquid stock. They haven't even done that, which is kind of weird. It's kind of weird. I mean, look, there's another issue, and it ties into why Musk has always preferred debt deals and convertible debt deals rather than equity deals. He knows one of the things keeping this stock afloat at such a ridiculous valuation is a relatively limited float, right? Relative market cap. And he knows that the more stock that gets out there, you know, the more air comes out of this Tesla stock right. bubble, right? Because then the float's less restricted. So that's probably another reason. But, you know, listen.
Yeah, I always wondered about that. You know, when the stock was at 370 and they went out and, you know, issued a bond, and a junk bond, instead of tapping the equity market.
That was always wondered why that was. Of 17. Is that yeah. where the stock was then? I don't remember.
It was at 370. It was at the all-time high before it last made its all-time high.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. So, you know, but that right. That's exactly the reason why. And of course, those bonds are now, you know, way underwater. Spreads blowing out this week, and you know, but that's part of the lawsuit because you know, there's a big civil lawsuit from those guys because one of the ways he sold those bonds was promising a much better Model 3 production schedule. And what we didn't talk about tonight yet so far is part of Moody's credit rating for those bonds, which is a pretty shitty rating as it is. The only reason it's not worse is they said one of the things was predicated on Tesla producing more than 5,000 Model 3s a week.
And right.
not only have they never reached that level of steady state production, but they can't even sell that many, you know? So a Moody's downgrade has to be in the cards unless those guys are just going to be like they were during the housing crisis and just, you know, sit on their ass with their eyes closed and just wait till it all blows up.
Well,
and then
nobody fucking expects anything from Moody's, number one. Number two, you know, what does it look like? Say they do come out and downgrade them. What happens?
Well, I don't know. I mean, look, I'm not a bond guy. I mean, one of the reasons the spreads are blowing out could be because that downgrade is being sort of priced in ahead of time.
Right. Yeah, and the bonds have been falling over the last relative to the equity. Delta has gotten bigger over the last 2 months.
Anybody who owns this stock, obviously, to your point, and I assume your point was nothing would happen. Anybody who owns this stock pays no attention to bond spreads or Moody's or anything else anyway. They're just in their own world of stupidity. But again, those guys, the large guys, not mom and pop dummy, but huge institutional dummy, once they realize this isn't an exciting growth story, that's it. It's like they're gone and they move on. And, you know, maybe that's what's happening here. Maybe that's what happened yesterday. Maybe that's what happened today. And maybe this will continue to happen.
Certainly feels like a new chapter in terms of
yes,
they've blown through a majority of those Model 3 reservations. They still haven't delivered the quote-unquote flagship model that they want to produce. They don't have the cash to go out and start working on a new model. It certainly feels like this thing is moving into another gear. But in all fairness, you know, I said that about Herbalife for years. And
well, exactly. I mean, this stock has had 99 lives. And what's obvious to me and to you and to a lot of other people, you know, who are short this, and a lot of smart people short this thing, apparently hasn't been obvious to the people who are long. I mean, one of the reasons I've been short this for years is, you know, 3 years ago, I saw the Jaguar I-Pace. You know, I saw the Audi e-tron. I saw the Porsche Mission E back then. You know, you saw all these cars. They were all like, yeah, we're going to build these cars. And I'm like, well, this is obvious. These cars are going to come out. They're all better than the Teslas. And they're going to blow the Teslas away. And, you know, it's 3 years from now or 3.5 years, whatever, 4 years. But the stock market is a discounting mechanism. And anybody with a brain in his head will say, oh, this is just going to be a dead car company. Apparently, it didn't work that way, right? So, you know, but the same thing, by the way, happened on the broad market, you know. So, I mean, a year and a half ago, I was like, well, wait a second. QE is over and quantitative tightening has been announced
right.
from both the Fed and Europe, and the Fed is steadily raising rates.
Right.
It's obvious that the stock market is going to collapse every day now because it's obvious the only thing propping it up was money printing. And once you reverse that and you're taking away tens of billions a month, guess what? It just didn't fucking happen until Q4.
Right.
And maybe the only reason it happened in Q4 was the ECB really did cut monthly printing from 30 billion euros to 15. And then the last 2 weeks of December, it went to zero.
Right.
And maybe people, no one looked ahead. I don't know. It's been a real handicap to anybody who looks ahead in this market and uses common sense because you've just been inevitably too early, right? Or at least I have.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. You're 100% right. I had one of my patrons wanted me to ask you, and I don't know if you follow the FX markets at all, but he wanted to know if you caught the flash crash from yesterday in the currency market. Did you see that? Do you even pay attention to the currency markets at all?
It was absolutely shocking. So I've literally been short yen against the dollar. So I'm long USD JPY for literally 6 years now, from when USD JPY was 79.
Right.
And just for the simple reason that, you know, Japan printing that much money year after year after year after year, at some point that currency collapses and I can sit and wait. So I did see that. It was absolutely stunning because, you know, USD JPY thing closed the sort of the 24-hour trading day. It was in the 108s, and I was doing something, but I had an eye on the screen, and I'm like, whoa, 107s, 106s, 105s, 104s.
Right.
I think I tweeted about it even before Zero Hedge, who's usually really fast tweeting about that. I tweeted like, holy shit, look at USD JPY. So I did catch it, and I did nothing because this is a very long-term position right. for me, and short-term fluctuations like that don't bother me other than, you know, they're interesting. And, you know, so it's
you think that was just an aftershock of the Apple news just kind of carrying over one way or another to the currency
market?
That's
the theory, right? I mean, the theories are that that's like that hour between 5 and 6 when, you know,
There's no futures trading. There's no nothing.
So the U.S. trading desks go home and the right. Asian trading desks haven't come in yet or whatever. And so there's that sort of air pocket of what do they call, you know, the housewife in Japan, Mrs. Wanatabi or whatever, you know, got stopped out of her yen carry trade or whatever. And, you know, and the yen just, you know, soared, right? So, yeah, it was interesting. But I don't think it's particularly meaningful. I mean what's amazing to me is, you know, and again, this is a different discussion, but if you look at debt to GDP in Japan and you look at how much money they've printed and what they've done to the monetary base, the fact that the yen is considered like a currency you go to for safety in a time of crisis, I mean, one day, you know, one day that's just not going to happen.
Yeah,
you know, and just, in fact, yep. the yen may be the cause of the crisis on that day.
Yep.
And it's just impossible to know when that's going to happen. It's not that different from the psychology of when things flip on Tesla or when the stock market starts tanking because people realize, oh, guess what? You know, the Fed doesn't have my back anymore. That's going to happen one day on the yen. I just don't know when. I mean, I've been sitting there for 6 years. We've made a little money, you know, not much. We haven't lost any. I don't mind parking money in something that I consider to be an eventual sure thing.
Right.
You have to just do it with minimal leverage. I've actually used an ETF in my fund, YCS. It's levered 2-to-1, and I'm just sitting there with it.
Yeah, and I've had people ask me the same stuff about gold since I did that presentation in May of last year, which, okay, wasn't even a year ago. And I've gotten emails and I've gotten, you know, direct messages and texts from people that I know. You know, they're following the day-to-day fluctuations in gold. And I'm like, come the fuck back to me in 10 years. You know what I mean? Like, it's the same type of situation, right?
And it's not that different. I mean,
I'm going to buy it at 1310. I'm going to buy it at 1200. I'm going to buy it at 1000. I'm going to buy it at 1400. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just buying it. Just like you're just shorting the yen.
It's interesting. It is similar to gold in that. I mean, gold did have a huge move, you know, during the financial crisis, right? And it got way ahead of itself in terms of the rate of inflation. And in fact,
sure,
even now, gold is way ahead of itself in terms of the actual amount of inflation, you know, that we've had, you know, since in the time that gold made that huge move, even though
right.
it's regressed from that move. But on the other hand, you could argue, well, you know, all that money's been printed and it continues to be printed here in the U.S. I mean,
oh,
we don't have QE, but we're running up massive deficits and borrowing money. And that's just like Tinder to one day send gold to $5,000 an ounce.
And I will argue that. I mean, and that's just, you know, look, at the very least, you think of it as an insurance policy, right? I mean, for me, I think of it as more than that. And I don't ask people, I don't tell people what to invest. I tell people what I do and I tell people what my thoughts are. And a lot of people hate me for it and some people like me for it and whatever. But that's how I think about it. Look, number one, it's an insurance policy. So if I wake up tomorrow morning and everything is fucked for one reason or another, you know, somebody puts a Kraft single slice of American cheese into one of the servers at the New York Stock Exchange, or, you know, somebody at the Fed fucking drops their bologna sandwich on the wrong keyboard. You know, if something goes wrong like that and we have a systemic problem somehow, you know, it's insurance against that. But, you know, I'm not thinking about it on a day-to-day basis. I'm not thinking about it on a year-to-year basis. I'm thinking about it on a much longer scale. And, you know, look, you could be very right that relative to the amount of real inflation that we've had, the amount of absolute inflation we've had, or even relative to the amount of inflation we've had as it's been reflected in the CPI, that yes, maybe it's still a little bit of ahead of itself, whatever. But it's just one of those things where, like, I'm just going to turn around and I'm just going to buy it. And if it goes to $5,000 an ounce, all right, we'll talk. But, you know, for the most part now, I'll turn around, I'll buy it. I'll buy it here. I'll buy it. It's the same deal with the yen. Same deal with shorting the yen. It's, you know, the same way I feel eventually about the dollar, probably on a much longer scale than the yen. But I mean, the yen's a perfect example. I mean, at some point that, I think the yen will just be looked at as, you know, Venezuelan bolivars. It's just probably take a little bit longer time to play out. But I don't disagree with you at all.
Well, I mean, look, so, you know, and obviously you know this, but, you know, what Buffett would say about gold, and he's got a fair point, is, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but he would say, yeah, I understand you wanting some inflation protection, and I understand you wanting to own hard assets, but, you know, why don't you own hard assets that are productive and less dependent on psychology? So why don't you buy farmland, you know? Why don't you buy, you know, some kind of prime real estate, you know, where you get inflation, you know, you raise the rent every year, you know? Why don't you do that? So, you know, that's not wrong either. You know, I've never owned gold. Wow. But on the other hand, I do understand for everything you said, why people want to own gold. It's sort of an easy way to protect yourself rather than actually
farmland rises in value as denominated by what?
Say that again?
I said farmland that would rise in value as denominated what by what, U.S. dollars?
Yeah, by U.S. dollars. So, you know, if all of a sudden an ear of corn goes from a dollar to $5,000, well, you know, an acre of farmland will go up proportionately with that.
Yeah, but farmland can't be used as currency, though, in a situation like that. You're not gonna, if shit gets real bad and the dollar winds up completely fucked and we have a major fiat currency crisis, you're not gonna slice off a piece of your farmland and hand it to a guy every time you want to fucking buy a car or buy a sandwich.
No, but when you get a fiat currency crisis, you know, the dollar bill gets revalued.
And by the way, gold does have use, you know, and silver does as well, you know, for a myriad of production uses. So it doesn't only have value as an economic instrument, as it has had for thousands of years, but it also has industrial uses as well.
Of course, but the main component of, you know, the price of gold is you know, that psychological component. I mean,
that's
what
part
are you
of
thinking
it.
Here, that the U.S. currency will collapse and you're gonna go to the local deli and get a turkey sandwich with a gram of gold? I mean, if we're that fucked, you know,
I don't think it's likely. I don't think we'll wake up tomorrow and that's going to be the case. But I sure as hell don't think that it's as unlikely as everybody makes it out to be. And
so what do you have? You have physical gold somewhere and you're planning on...
That's the point that I would argue. I have it in many different ways. I have bullion. I have physical gold. I own gold ETFs. I own gold miners. I've had exposure to gold futures. So
gold miners and gold ETFs, those are pieces of paper that would get paid in dollars.
I understand that.
You collect your farmland rent in dollars.
I understand that. So just like I said in my May presentation, you know, there's very conservative ways that you can have exposure to it. One is physically owning it. And there's more speculative ways that you can own it, which is, you know, tied to an ETF where if BlackRock goes under, your ETF's fucked no matter what. So, you know, there's a bunch of different ways. And what I personally like to do is diversify the way that I own it across all of these different methods, and then some other methods as well. And, you know,
you're going to be in some post-apocalyptic world where you're using gold as a method of commerce. I mean, do you have a hell of a gun collection to go along with that?
Yes. I can't have one without the other. Otherwise, I'm just stockpiling gold for the guy around the corner that's got more guns than I do. That guy comes around with a fucking AK-47 and says, give me all your gold. I'm out of fucking ideas at that point.
But you know, even there, you're going to be outgunned. You know, even there.
I see your point. I think you make a very fair point. I think it is more likely than not that situation does not arise, although, you know, our situation about hyperinflation in the yen, I think, is a possibility. However, I think that just like with any bubble, just like with any confidence game, when people start to feel as though they, you know, have this arrogance that they have the answer, that they've come up with the system that's going to work. And, you know, the people in charge are fully confident in the decisions that they're making and fully confident in theory as it exists today. I think the further we move into that territory, maybe it's just very, very, very fractional chance, but I think the further we move into that territory, the more likely it becomes that there's a possibility of there being cracks in the surface. And I don't know if they're big or, and I don't know if they're small. And I, you know, look, I hope they don't happen in my lifetime. But at the end of the day, you know, I can't ignore that. I can't not, you know, because it's something that I think about often, right? So, you know, look, it's just, and it's not, I have a portfolio of equities that only pays dividends, right? I have a couple of different little portfolios, little books that I run, right? And one of them is a long-term dividend-paying equity portfolio that's very similar to, you know, what Warren Buffett or Jeremy Siegel would recommend. And the purpose of that portfolio is essentially to buy into the system and to buy into, you know, monetary policy and economic theory as we see it today, where ostensibly, you know, 30 years from now, the Dow could be at a million and, you know, I could have been compounding dividends for 30 years. So I have exposure to that theory. And I also have exposure to if that doesn't work and in a worst case scenario. And I just think a broader point that I'd make would be people that believe diversification is just diversifying yourself in dollar denominated assets, whether it's, you know, stocks and bonds. Oh, I'm diversified. I look at diversification differently. I look at it, you know, from a currency standpoint.
Well, I think gold is an excellent sort of easy safety net if we do get serious inflation in this country. And, you know, anyone who had 5 or 10% or 15%, whatever, of their net worth in gold, I'm fine with that. I wouldn't mock that or laugh at that or whatever. But if you're going to go a step further to like a post-apocalyptic world where gold is the method of commerce, that's like, you know, it's guns at that point.
Well, it doesn't have to be gold. It can be gold-backed currencies. You know what I mean? It could just be returning to a gold standard. It doesn't have to be physical gold.
Yeah, that's, you know, I don't know.
But look, your point is well taken. Okay, your point's well taken, and I'm not suggesting that we're going to wake up in some type of apocalypse tomorrow. But on the other hand, I don't want to have to fucking wonder. I don't, you know, for me, it's just, I don't know. It's more.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I mean, what if you don't mind my asking, are you willing to say what percentage of your portfolio is in gold?
I would probably, if I had to guess off the top of my head, I'd say between 10 and 20%.
That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. You might be foregoing some return there, but you know what? It's a safety net, and you have it.
I'm not foregoing shit because I'm not that fucking hard on about whether I'm making 6% or 5% in a year. It's not bothersome to me. You know what I mean? So this idea of foregoing return, you know, look, in essence, you could just say I'm paying a little bit more for a little bit more insurance is
one
way to
think about it. Well, that's perfectly fine. No, I understand that. That's the flip side of it. It makes sense. It's fine.
You know, but like I always say, I take exception to people that are like, oh, it doesn't pay a dividend, you know? It's like,
No, I understand. Listen, you know, we talked about this, I think, last time, that there's no doubt in my mind that the end road for this country in the U.S. dollar is hyperinflation because politicians have been enabled to spend money and not pay. Mm-hmm. Hell, this dummy
So, I mean, in a situation like that, don't you see it as inevitable that we wind up with you know, some form of the gold standard again? Accepted globally?
Well, I don't know. We could wind up at that point with the yuan standard, because that's, although they're as fucked as we are, maybe worse. I mean, in other words, like when Venezuela, or, you know, when all these countries sort of recalibrate their currencies, it's been to the, a lot of times anyway, it's been to the U.S. dollar, maybe not Venezuela.
Venezuela,
you know,
has
saying,
just,
right?
No, because
the U.S. dollar has been the gold standard. When the U.S. dollar goes, I don't know if another currency is the gold standard. But it sure doesn't look that way. Or if there's a literal gold standard. I mean, my only issue is
Venezuela is now backing their currency with oil and mineral reserves.
Yeah. But I mean, just these things can just take a very, very long time. But again, maybe they don't even happen.
You know?
Yeah. No, we're on the same page. I mean, you know, for peace of mind that way, It makes perfect sense.
But if it does happen, I don't want to be standing there holding my Schwans going, oh, wow, fuck, you know, I kind of thought that this was a 0.001% possibility, and I just kind of, you know.
But look, like, so the flip side of that is, if the whole country doesn't fall apart, right, and instead of gold, you had that money in, and this is what Buffett would say, you know, Procter & Gamble stock.
Sure.
Which, whatever it pays, a 3% dividend. But more importantly, it can raise the price of a bar of soap or a thing of shampoo, you know, to keep up to pace with inflation. You know, I mean, why not? I mean, you know, why is gold going to be better than that?
Because everything that they sell is going to be denominated in U.S. dollars, right?
Yeah, but those dollars, you'll be able to use those dollars. So, you know, so a sandwich, instead of costing $7, will cost $7,000. But you're a Procter and Gamble. But you're Procter and Gamble that you paid whatever. I don't even know where the stock is anymore.
Right.
You know, $80 a share. I have no idea where it is. Yeah, you know, will be like, you know, $800,000 a share. You know what I'm saying?
I see your point. I understand what you're saying. I get your point. And as I said earlier, look, it's not as if I subscribe to, you know, the world is fucked and that's the only way I see things going. Again, I just think Just as I would say about the media and the media's inherent long bias, I think that the other side to the equation needs to be presented and it needs to be respected. And I don't think that that is necessarily happening. I don't think that.
That's fair. And I agree. And you know what? The thing about gold is it would get you the same place. Yeah, you give up the dividends on the way, but you don't have to worry about is Procter & Gamble going to survive that hyperinflation,
right?
Or is, you know, Boeing or is some other company. It's just gold is gold, and it stood the test of time.
Yeah, there's no management team. Right, exactly.
Hey, well, that's why I laughed at the whole Bitcoin thing. People are like, well, Bitcoin, it'll be a stable store of value when they kill the dollar.
Until the power goes out.
What's that?
Until the power goes out and you can't transact.
No, but I'm like, if that's what you want, just fucking get gold. Gold has a 5,000-year, whatever it is, history,
right,
of that. Bitcoin has a 5-year history of being all over the place. I never understood it. Bitcoin, to me, all that was a way for people to launder money and do shady transactions and, you know, basically manipulate a trading market. Because the much more logical way to get that effect would be, as you said, just buy gold. It stood the test of time.
Right. Well, that's specifically what, you know, Bitcoin's getting a lot of its use doing that. And if you look at these guys that are running these Bitcoin ATMs, you know, they're showing up in areas that have heavy drug populations, that have heavy illegal crime. You know, there's something like, I was reading an article, I forget where it was. It was probably Zero Hedge, but I was reading an article that said, you know, Bitcoin ATMs are popping up in Detroit, you know, in the ghetto, you know, and it's like, these people are not fucking currency speculators. You know what I mean? Like they're buying
way,
and selling drugs.
Obvious that government would get on top of that. You know, the IRS, you know, look, they don't catch on to it right away, but they catch on to
Once
it.
Once it becomes a big enough problem, they will, right? It's like
course.
Silk Road, right? I mean, Silk Road.
Potential source of funds.
Right.
Because we're talking about the government.
Oh,
here,
yeah,
right?
Right. Yeah, something they can tax.
Yeah, so that, you know, that whole thing was a joke. It's still a joke. I don't even know where it is now. Last I looked, it was like in the 4,000s, but I don't even know.
And, of course, who's the first analyst that CNBC had on this year was the guy that predicted it was going to 50,000. That was like the first guy on the first day that they came back live after the new year. You know, there was
so
like,
was
all
that
right.
Tom Lee or was it?
Oh, it was Tom Lee. Yeah, they were like, we're going to open the year up with Tom Lee. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me?
So CNBC has become a fucking disgrace to business humanity. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but when Bitcoin was hot, they had a fucking Bitcoin ticker on the screen, you know, like all day long, showing the price of Bitcoin ticking up, as if it were a real legitimate asset. They are such a trend chasing bunch of whores. Their credibility is just so gone. I know we talked about this last time.
We know
time,
this, and my listeners know this. There was some poetic justice that was doled out today, which was, I don't know if you saw it, but Fleckenstein was on my podcast in October.
I did see it. Yeah, I love it.
He came on. He basically said Apple was fucked in October when, you know, I think it was at 220 or 210, and I actually argued with him about it a little bit, and then he made his point. He made his point about China and saturation and basically everything that's happened. And then all of a sudden, from October to now, the stock's down something like 40%. Now, one of the reasons I invited Fleckenstein on my podcast to begin with was because he had gone on CNBC, everybody knows, in 2017, and Tim Seymour was giving him the business and was being an asshole to him to the point where Fleckenstein had to say, hey, don't be a jerk to me. So I said, this would be a great guy to open the podcast with up. Well, sure as shit, Apple craters 40% in the next 2 months, almost as soon as he made the call. And Fleckenstein tweets out today, oh, CNBC asked me to come on and talk about Apple. You know, it's like, and he said no.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, how did they know he was short Apple to begin with? Well, because he was on my fucking podcast, and I'm not trying to be Mr. Big Head, ego, whatever. But, that's a small victory. It's a small victory for the little guy, and it goes to show you.
Their victory is probably CNBC's ratings, which I assume have been in the toilet. You know, I haven't looked in a long time, but they were terrible. I mean, Mark Haynes was awesome, right, in the morning, and Mark Haynes tragically died, you know, of that heart attack or whatever, way too young, and since then it's just been total. I mean, in fairness, there's some good report. I mean, David Faber does good work, you know, for what he does, and you know, the guy who hosts the noon show is actually pretty good, you know, but...
Yeah, Wapner. There's a couple people that I don't mind, and I was talking about them on another podcast. Like, I can listen to Carl Quintanilla. He's relatively objective, and I don't mind Becky Quick in the morning, you know.
Well, so let's talk... So, by the way, you know, on a personal basis, I've met some of these people. They may not have remembered meeting me. They are universally very, very nice people. So
yes.
Nothing I'm saying here is meant to say that any of these are not, you know, nice, you know, good people. But there's just no critical thinking on that network for the most part, you know? I mean, there's no, like, picking apart the story that some CEO or some analyst is telling you. It's just that's my issue. Mark Haynes, who I think was a lawyer before he became a TV anchor, before he came to CNBC – Mark Haynes engaged in critical thinking. There just isn't enough of it going on that
right.
channel. Yeah. Saw it once from Kelly Evans when she, who was she? She was taking apart somebody doing a really great job. It was that VC who had lost the money in Theranos, Draper, and was still defending the company. Kelly did a great job on him, but you don't see enough of that.
Right.
You know, it's
yeah.
you know,
and especially now without Herb
Bitcoin
Greenberg,
was just ridiculous.
Herb Greenberg used to do a good job too.
Yeah, Herb was good, but Herb's you know doing his own thing and semi-retired in San Diego. He's got his research shop out there.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. So, yeah. Anyways, all right, Mark. Well, listen, we can sit here and talk shit all afternoon, but I gotta go downstairs and make myself a sandwich, and I'm sure you have things to do.
Well, I'm going to go lift some weights because I just want to be half the size you are.
Oh, God. Stop. What are you talking about? You know, I'm a mess. Anyways.
Well, I don't know. Those tattoos make you look actually scarier than you probably are.
I'm not a very scary person. I'm a very meek man, and that's all you need to know about me. Anyways, listen, dude, it was awesome having you on again, and let's check back in a couple months or the next time the shit hits the fan, and we'll do it all again.
Well, Tesla shit is always hitting the fan. So, you know, we could check back in again in about 2 hours.
When one of
hours.
The larger chunks of shit hits the fan.
We'll check. Take care, man. Good talking to you.
All right, Mark. Talk to you later, buddy.
Bye-bye.
That was Mark Spiegel of Stanfield Capital being nice enough to come on. Oh, what's on here on my phone? Did I miss something? No, I don't think I missed something. I thought a headline had broke in the midst of my interview, but it doesn't look like that happened. Anyways, Mark Spiegel, awesome to have him back on again. And real quick, before I say peace, I will say one more time thank you to my patrons, some of the people that have supported me, especially the guys at Quantumize and my friend Scott Corsi, guys like Austin Winrow and Bradford Keller. Really appreciate you guys. Chris Hicks, Chris Ward. Thank you guys very much for your continued support. It's fucking awesome to be back. We're going to take it to the next level in 2019. I'm stoked about that little win we had on the Fleckenstein thing. Fleck's going to be back next week, so we'll be speaking to him then. I have a couple of guests I'm still trying to line up. I have a couple of people that have just told me no. So you know that the podcast is getting out there because I have a feeling my reputation is preceding me amongst the people that are serious money managers and serious financial media people. Because these people have said, I'm sorry, I just can't, I don't think I can have my boss's approval to come on your podcast. Or I'm sorry, what is he saying, Back to the Future? I'm afraid you're just too damn loud. Anyways, fuck them, we don't need them. I'm here, you're here. Chug the rest of that beer, and let's get on with the rest of our night. All right, for now, I am out. Peace.